divided between sunsets and fusion generators. That's conspiracy and restraint of trade. The GEC will be all over us in 10 minutes. My lawyers assure me, your lawyers are full of shit if they're telling you we can carve up the energy market between us without the GEC slapping us both in jail. We can handle the GEC. And rain makes applesauce. You would have made such an arrangement with my father. That stunned Dan into silence. Wouldn't you? Nobo demanded. Dan had no reply. You don't wish to make such an arrangement with Yamagata Industries now that I am at its head? Nobo, I can't. Then you have decided to try to drive us out of the energy business? No, not at all. I'm offering you a share of the fusion operation, and you ought to get your marketing people to start looking at how the sunsets can be used to deliver power to other space facilities. Hell, you could beam power all the way out to the asteroid belt if you wanted to. There is nothing in the asteroid belt that needs gigawatts of power, but there will be. Things don't stand still, Nobo. Don't try to freeze everything in place. You'll get swamped by the changes that can't be stopped. Stop lecturing me. I'm not a child. Double damn it to hell and back, Nobo. You're taking this personally. It's not personal, it's business. The younger man got to his feet and reached for his suit jacket. You must pardon me. I am to chair the board meeting in Tokyo this morning. I will leave word to make a plane available for your flight to Tahiti.
Tetiaroa, Dan corrected glumly.
Wherever. Goodbye.
Nobuhiko left without a bow, without a handshake, clearly furious and not even trying to hide his emotions. Dan stood at the table thinking, great way to start the day. I've just made an enemy out of my old friend's son. Jane had not slept well either. She suppressed the memory of her dreams, recalling only vague images of scenes from her childhood and of Morgan, her dead husband.
I pushed him into politics, Jane said to herself as she showered. I made him president. I killed him.
But not before Morgan himself had killed the love that they had shared.
I pushed him into politics, but I didn't force him to take up with those other women. Groupies, power-hungry bitches who slept with the high and the mighty regardless of who they might be.
Then her anger dissolved as she realized that it was indeed truly her fault. All of it was her own fault. If she had let Morgan alone, allowed him to live the quiet, obscure life he had originally wanted, he would be alive today, and he would still love no one but her.
But would I love him? Jane asked herself as she dressed. Did I ever really love him? Or did I merely see in Morgan a man who could be guided to greatness? Maybe I was his original groupie. Until I met Dan.
With an effort of steel-hard will, Jane shut off her thoughts.
I have a job to do, and I'm going to do it.
She had her limousine drive her to Orly, where she boarded the Air France flight for Papeete. The hypersonic jet would whisk her to Tahiti in just over 2 hours. There, a chartered plane waited to fly her to Tetiaroa. And there, Dan Randolph would be waiting. Maybe. With a start, she realized that she had not told Vasily Malik that she was on her way to rendezvous with Dan.
I could call him from here in the plane, she thought, before the re-entry blackout. Or at the airport in Papeete. Or better yet, I'll wait until I actually see Dan on Tetiaroa.
Yes, she said to herself, I'll wait. It will be better to make certain he's really there before I tell Vasily the good news. 11. Winging over the broad Pacific, Dan thought how convenient it would be if he had a seaplane at his disposal. A flying boat that could travel at supersonic speed and land anywhere on the ocean, or a river or a lake. But supersonic speed was just not enough for a man with global interests. The Yamagata plane he was in could do Mach 3, and it was taking hours to reach Tetiaroa. A commercial hypersonic space plane, the kind that arched high above the atmosphere and came back down like a re-entering rocket, could cross the Pacific in less than an hour. I'll have to phone Jane and tell her I'm at the island, he thought. She won't come over until she's certain I'm there. She never wants to be the first one there, wherever it is. She'd rather be 6 hours late than 2 minutes early. He felt a worrisome uneasiness about calling Jane to confirm that he was on Tetiaroa. Too many other people could find out. Somebody like Malik, or one of those other paper-pushing bureaucrats at the GEC. Dan did not like to let his enemies know his whereabouts too precisely, not unless he was safely ensconced in one of his own strongholds, surrounded by friends. Friends. He thought about Nobuhiko again. Maybe I ought to at least try to work out something with him. He's right. Sai and I would have put together some kind of a deal. I shouldn't have shut him off so abruptly. No wonder he's sore. I'll have to get back to him, try to work out some kind of plan. The plane droned on. Dan was the only passenger in the six-seat compartment. The flight attendant, an attractive, slim young Japanese woman, was sitting in the front row, raptly watching a no-drama on video. Dan gazed out the window at the glittering Pacific. Nothing but sea and sky as far as the eye could see in any direction, and towering cumulus clouds reaching up beyond their cruising altitude. "Mr. Randolph-san," the pilot's voice came humming over the intercom. "We are being routed around a major storm system by traffic control. It will cause an unavoidable delay in our scheduled arrival, sir." The flight attendant glanced back over her shoulder at him, as if to ask what he intended to do about the news. Dan shrugged at her. She turned her attention back to her video screen. Dan tried to work. He called his office in Caracas and then his headquarters at Alfonsus. He plugged his pocket computer into the video screen on the back of the seat in front of him and went through the day's inputs of data. Bored by it, he switched to the global news channel and saw that the big story was the unseasonable typhoon that had torn across Samoa and was now bearing down on the Gilbert Islands. The screen showed a devastated city on one of the Samoan islands. Dan had not caught which one. Buildings blown down, trees scattered across streets and roads like tenpins, cars crushed, people homeless, fierce gray surf still pounding the beaches, UN peacekeeping troops flying in with their sky-blue helicopters to build shelters and bring food and medicine. Then the scene shifted to the peaceful atoll of Tarawa. "Scarcely 5 meters above sea level at its highest point," the voiceover said in a crack of doom voice, "this scene of one of World War II's bloodiest battles may soon face an even more disastrous fate. Mother Nature on a rampage." Dan stared at the flat sandy islands of the atoll. Cripes, it's just like Tetiaroa. If that kind of storm hit Tetiaroa, there'd be nothing left afterward. He waited until the newscast turned to its resident meteorologist and his maps. With considerable relief, Dan saw that the typhoon, named Alphonse, was moving west by north, away from Tetiaroa. "It is very early in the season for a killer typhoon of such mammoth size and strength," the meteorologist was intoning, while the screen showed a satellite view of the storm. It was mammoth. Its huge, swirling bands of clouds covered thousands of square kilometers. "And this is only the first storm in what promises to be a very long and very dangerous hurricane season." No mention of the greenhouse. Dan switched off the video as the newscast switched to the sports report. Looking out the plane's window, he could see a gray smudge far off on the horizon. Alphonse. Silly name for a killer. Greenhouse warming of the atmosphere does more than melt glaciers, Dan knew. The warmer the atmosphere, the more energy it stores. The more energy, the bigger and more frequent storms, such as hurricanes and typhoons. "It's a good thing I'm going to see Jane," he realized. "I've got to convince her about Zach's greenhouse cliff data." At one time, the airport at Tetiaroa had been a strip of sand on the atoll's largest island alongside the hotel. A small plane could taxi right up to the open-air registration desk. Passengers stepping out of the plane would be greeted by the room clerk and a grinning bare-chested bellman. Supersonic jets required longer and stronger runways, however. The French government had started to build a jet landing strip on the next islet on the coral chain, but the people of Tahiti had won their independence before the project could be completed, and for years the jet airport languished half-built. Finally, a Japanese-Australian consortium bought the hotel, finished the airstrip, and even connected the two aisles with a paved road and a concrete bridge arched high enough to allow dugout canoes to pass under it. The consortium